I'm joined on the phone by award-winning Seattle filmmaker Jill Friedberg. She is in Oaxaca right now. We're going to be talking about the teacher strike there as well as the wider movement. Friedberg's 2005 film Granito de Arena is an award-winning film, as well as her documentary This Is What Democracy Looks Like, which she produced in 2000. Her film, Granito de Arena, is the story of the popular resistance in Mexico to the global economic forces that have been dismantling public education for over 20 years. It is the story of hundreds of thousands of public school teachers whose grassroots nonviolent movement took Mexico by surprise and who have endured brutal repression in their 26-year struggle for social and economic justice in Mexico's public schools. Jill Friedberg spent 2 years in southern Mexico documenting the efforts of over 100,000 teachers, parents, and students fighting to defend the country's public education system from the devastating impacts of economic globalization. She's also a founding member of the Seattle Independent Media Center and works with several independent media collectives and indigenous community radio stations in Mexico and with community radio station KBCS in Seattle, Washington. And she also founded Corrugated Films in 2002, which works to build solidarity and understanding between communities of action through the grassroots production and distribution of video, radio, and other forms of independent media. Their website is corrugate.org. I'm very pleased to be joined by Jill right now from Oaxaca. Hello. Can you hear me?
Hi there. Hi. Yeah, I can hear you.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today. We could just start out by talking about the current situation, what has gone on today and just in recent days in Oaxaca, if you could fill us in on what's the current information.
Well, the federal police maintain the very center of the historic center of Oaxaca City, the Zocalo, are maintaining an occupation there since they arrived 3 weeks ago on October 29th. And the movement, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, has held true to its commitment not to directly confront the federal police, but rather to carry out a series of nonviolent mobilizations to that don't involve confronting the federal police. Today, a group of women marched from the Plaza de Santo Domingo, which is where the movement is maintaining its encampment since it was removed by the Zocalo, by the federal police. And those women marched in response to an increasing number of reports that since the federal police arrived and took over the center of town, that they have been sexually harassing women who pass through and by the center of town that where the federal police are have their encampment. And so a large number of women went with their pots and their pans and also carrying mirrors. And on the mirrors they had written, I'm a rapist, I abuse women. And they marched right up to the lines of federal police and held the mirrors up to them and carried out a street performance in front of the police to help sensibilize them, as they say down here, as to the errors of their ways in harassing the women of Oaxaca. And the federal police responded by spraying them with the water tanks that they have, which contain water mixed with some sort of acid or chile, which burns the skin when it lands on you. And so that was their response to the women's peaceful attempt to bring into the light of the day the fact that while the federal police were supposedly brought to Oaxaca to restore quote unquote law and order, they've actually been more of a menace than anything else. And that's sort of how it's been since the police arrived. There have been a couple of fairly large scale confrontations between the movement and the police, including the day that the police arrived and then the day November 2nd when the police attempted to enter the university campus, which houses the university radio station that's currently being sort of the voice of the movement. But other than that, what we've seen is a lot of creativity, a lot of marches, and in several cases, even though those marches have not attempted to enter the area that's being held by the federal police, simply to pass by it, the police have responded with tear gas. They have slingshots that they're using to fire marbles at protesters, and then today the water cannons with water mixed with acid. So that's how the movement's been responding. The media has sort of stopped covering Oaxaca because people aren't being publicly are being killed on a regular basis, which seems to be what interests the commercial media. Meanwhile, there's this sort of surreal, sense that things have returned to normal in Oaxaca, when in fact, almost on a daily basis, people are being picked up by armed men in unmarked trucks without license plates. There's a list of over 30 people who have been disappeared, and people who are have been found but who are being held in custody without being charged, and those who have been released have given testimony of severe torture techniques being used against them. So that's the real reality of what's happening in Oaxaca beneath this sort of transparent fantasy of normalcy in Oaxaca.
You mentioned that there's at least 30 people right now where their whereabouts are unknown, basically have been disappeared. Is there nothing known at all about their whereabouts or how they're being treated? They're basically just, nobody knows anything about where they are. They could be dead for all their family members know. Is that the situation?
Yeah. I mean, the two local human rights organizations have been working around the clock 24 hours a day on trying to document the cases of disappearance and updating the lists. And in some cases, the people on that list are people who were seen being picked up and detained, in which case, but then have not been located in any of the prisons or jails in Oaxaca. And others are people who were present, for example, on October 27th when paramilitaries opened fire on several different barricades, killing at least three people, including indie media New York journalist Brad Will, or people who were in the city on October 29th when the federal police entered the city, but they're people who weren't actually witnessed being detained, but who have not shown up since those days. So they're suspected to either be that they're either being held somewhere, or in the case of the people who disappeared on October 27th when paramilitaries attacked the barricades, based on the testimonies of people who were there, there is a concern that some of those people are in fact dead and that their bodies just haven't been located.
So there's a fear that these people were detained or kidnapped or whatever and then killed because they were eyewitnesses to other killings? To the killing of Brad Will?
I mean, what we're talking about is sort of two different elements. The first one is local pro-government paramilitaries, which are often state or municipal police in plain clothes who are hired by the state government to attack the movement, and such as was the case that happened on October 27th. In that case, if those people are still being held, that's even more questionable because they're not actually being held by a legitimate, a legitimate quote-unquote police force. In that case, they may be people who are on that very same day were killed and their bodies disposed of somewhere other than the local morgue. And then in the case of people who have been disappeared since the federal police arrived, it's suspected that they have been that they're being detained and held somewhere. People who have been detained and released by the federal police, among their testimonies of torture, have talked about not being allowed to see where they were being held, of having their faces covered so that they can't, they can't say where they were being held or who they were being held by. So it's suspected that maybe on one of the military bases or something like that here in Oaxaca that there are people who've still been detained.
And you mentioned the radio station at the university, that it's the last radio station that APO or the Popular Assemblies of the People of Oaxaca are able to broadcast any of their message or information out to the public. Is that, the last I heard, that particular radio station was being interfered with by the government. They were sending another signal in with this repetitive song playing over and over, and it was blocking certain areas of the city from even receiving, I mean, from being able to hear the radio station. They were basically interfering with the signal. So what is the current situation with that radio station?
That's exactly what the current situation is. This is a radio station that's legally licensed. And not only is it legally licensed, but under Mexican law, once a public university achieves autonomy, federal intervention on the campus is not allowed without permission from the dean. And the dean in this case has been very supportive of the movement. So there's an argument that, in fact, interfering with the signal of the university radio station is also an unprohibited state intervention on, you know, on, or that they're violating the university autonomy. And it's, yeah, you, I mean, you captured it perfectly. There is, from another AM antenna, this horrible sort of Celtic rock song is being looped 24 hours a day on top of the university radio signal. At the same time, and this is a movement which, since it began in May, has counted on always having at least one media outlet, at least one radio station, and for 3 weeks they had taken over a public television station to use not only as a logistical but also as a political and cultural sort of center of the movement. So this has been a real big blow to the movement to not have a well-functioning radio. The other major blow has been that 3 or 4 weeks ago, a clandestine radio station started broadcasting on the FM dial called Citizen Radio by pro-government people who have this very rabid anti-movement discourse, where people have been calling in, for example, saying, if you see an independent foreign journalist, kill them, they're with the movement. So it's turned into a real media war, where you have on one hand the movement radio being really being weakened by this interference, and on the other hand, the only other radio available in Oaxaca right now is this pro-government radio station. All the other radio stations have gone off the air and closed their doors for fear that the movement will take over their radio station because of something that they've done in the past.
What do you think is motivating the people who are operating this clandestine radio station that's basically rabidly anti-APO and very pro-government? What is their motivation, do you think? And what are their complaints about the movement?
Well, this is the situation in Oaxaca right now is very polarized. I mean, you know, you could simplify it and say it's a class war, although I would say it's much more complicated than that. But there is an element of society in Oaxaca, primarily people coming from more economic privilege, people who typically, you know, grown up in the city and who are large business owners, people who have hotels, make a lot of money off the tourist industry, and then all the people who actually work for the state government, which is quite a few people, who have either felt very inconvenienced by the movement or have seen their businesses suffer, or who just simply support and benefit from the longstanding corruption that has existed in Oaxaca with under the PRI rule, and they saw how effective the movement radio stations were and sort of copied that model and are using the radio to rally support for the governor and against the movement.
How likely is it they're going to gain much support for the governor? My understanding of the situation in the state of Oaxaca is that Governor Ruiz is viewed as being in power illegitimately. This is generally speaking, it seems from what I've heard that the overwhelming majority of people in Oaxaca are not in approval, at the very least, of the governor, and many would like to see him are demanding that he step down. So what are the numbers here? You say it's a polarized situation. Do you have a small number on one side supporting the governor and the vast majority on the other wanting him to leave office? What's the numbers or the situation in that regard?
You know, it's hard to get a really clear sense, partly because this isn't just a movement within the city, but when you leave and go out into the rural parts of Oaxaca, unless you're there for a good chunk of time, it's really hard to get a sense what percentage of those communities it has taken aside or even is really getting enough information about the movement. And then in the city, for example, the pro-government side held a march, what they're calling a mega march, just 3 days after the movement held a mega march. And both marches were fairly large. There were, you know, unconfirmed rumors that the pro-government march included everybody who works for the government, who was told that if they didn't join the march that day, they would be fired. Again, those rumors are unconfirmed. But I suspect what I've been able to get a sense of is that the majority of people want the governor to leave or don't approve of the governor, even if they're not actively participating in the movement. They may even have criticisms of the movement. They may be small business owners who have because the movement has impacted them. Tourism has gone way down in Oaxaca, who would like to see the movement go away, but recognize that the only way that's going to happen is for the governor to leave. So if you ask them, do you want the governor to leave, they would say absolutely yes, but that doesn't mean that they're out in the marches or guarding the barricades. So it's more of a spectrum. I mean, it is polarized, at least in terms of the media war that's going on right now, but I'd say it's safe to say that the majority of the people in the state of Oaxaca, and especially in the city, see the solution as the resignation of the governor.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the history. I don't want to get into, you know, a great detail about it because I'm really interested in getting some of the current developments out there. But my understanding of the background on this is that basically we're talking about a state that is the second poorest in Mexico next to Chiapas, very high indigenous population, and there's been a lot of repression, government repression there. For the last 26 years, there's been a strike yearly, roughly in May, June, of the teachers demanding better wages, but also better conditions for the students. And this has generally resulted in negotiations for a couple of weeks that ultimately resulted in some slight pay raise, and then they go back to work, and then the next year they strike again. This year, my understanding is that this year the reason things escalated so much is that Governor Ruiz sent in the state police on June 14th to the teachers' camp, killing six people, including some children, which really escalated the struggle and widened it. And then what happened is that people have been getting periodically being killed by paramilitaries at the barricades around Oaxaca City, where you had a situation where after June 14th, one of the central demands of the movement became that Ruiz step down because they held him personally responsible for the killings, but for many other reasons as well. And then the strategy became to make the governor, basically to make Oaxaca ungovernable so that he would be forced to step down. And so in that process, there was a taking of a lot of radio stations, of the TV station, of Oaxaca City, and making barricades where people would stand guard. And this overwhelmingly, in my understanding, has not been a violent movement. I'm not saying that there hasn't been rock throwing or Molotov cocktails or some of this kind of thing, especially at the university on November 2nd, but it seems like the paramilitaries are targeting unarmed people at these barricades, shooting and killing about 19 at this point. A lot of whom were teachers, some of whom, you know, families had kids, were parents, had families they were supporting. And also Brad Will killed on October 27th by some local government forces. And then right after that, they decided, okay, the president decided to bring in the federal police, saying, federal forces, saying that, oh, we're going to restore order. Using the death of Brad Will and others as an excuse to come in and further repress people, not come in and arrest those responsible for killing Brad Will, not come in and arrest those responsible for killing the others, but to attack the people, to attack the movement, and to make it safe for tourism again. I mean, this is kind of my cursory knowledge or understanding of some of the history. Is that roughly accurate, or what is your... What do you have
to
say?
I mean, that's roughly accurate. One important clarification is that when the state police came in on June 14th and attacked the peaceful encampment of the striking teachers, there were a lot of unconfirmed rumors that circulated for quite some time after that that people had been killed in that, and actually no one was killed in that police attack on the teachers' encampment. So that's important to clarify. But I mean, basically, you summed it up. A little bit more background is that by the time June 14th came around and the governor sent in the state police to attack the striking teachers, he had already been in office for a year and a half, having entered through what was blatant electoral fraud, and had carried out a whole series of offenses against the people of Oaxaca, starting almost immediately with an attack on the newspaper Noticias, which is a which is less critical of the governor than some of the other newspapers in town, followed by a whole series of public works that were not needed, remodeling of parks, the expansion of a highway that resulted in a massive landslide down on top of several neighborhoods. All of these public works apparently as a money laundering scheme so that he could funnel a lot of public money from the state of Oaxaca into the presidential campaign of the PRI candidate, Roberto Madrazo. So the Oaxacan people were already pretty cranky with this governor when June 14th came around and he sent in the police to attack the school teachers, which was something that hadn't been done in years. And that was, it was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And the people came out not only in support of the teachers, but also with this ultimate demand that the governor has to leave. And that was what sparked the formation of the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca. And what's really important to understand is that the People's Assembly, which is called the APO, is not an organization and it's not an association. It's an assembly, which in Oaxaca has a very profound, significant relationship to Oaxaca's indigenous nature. It's a consensus-based decision-making body that in which over 350 organizations and communities and unions and neighborhoods participate, and it is essentially a leaderless organization, even though the mainstream press had really focused on a few individuals who were part of what was called the collective provisional leadership of the assembly. But it's basically a leaderless movement that makes decisions based on consensus, and they made the decision that in order to get rid of the governor, the state of Oaxaca would have to be deemed ungovernable, which is actually in the Constitution. If you can determine that all three levels of government are not functioning, the Senate can then what they call disappear powers, which means basically remove the current government and hold new elections. And that's what the movement has been attempting to do since June. They took over and established encampments in front of all the state government buildings, the Congress building, the governor's building, and also took over several radio stations, although that was more not so much to create ungovernability, but to A, have a voice for the movement, and B, to in response to attacks on legitimate existing radio stations, such as the teachers' radio station, Radio Plantón, which was destroyed on June 14th, and University Radio, which was destroyed in August and just recently was able to get back on the air. And the establishing of barricades, which happened at the end of August, was also in response to that when the television station that had been taken over by several thousand women was attacked by armed plainclothes state police who shot up the transmitter after shooting at the teachers who were guarding the transmitter. And the movement's response to that was to take over every single AM and FM radio station in the city, and then they gave back all but two of those stations. The state's response to that was to send out convoys, literally 40 trucks at a time full of armed state police, firing on the protesters who were guarding the radio stations, and neighborhoods decided fairly spontaneously that the way to defend themselves from that was to put up barricades, starting with about 500 barricades, but going up to almost 2,000 barricades that went up every night in the city of Oaxaca and became a cultural phenomenon where neighbors would spend the night together around the barricades guarding their neighborhoods, and that remained the situation until the federal police entered on October 29th.
There was recently a Congress of the APO. Can you talk about that? When that took place, what the purpose of it was, and what the outcome was?
That took place last weekend, if I'm not, the weeks are going by, I'm fairly certain that took place last weekend, and it was a statewide Congress to to find a way to move forward from what had been this provisional, temporary, collective sort of leadership body of the movement, and to also discuss what the OPPO's plan will be if and when the governor leaves, how to rethink governance in Oaxaca and prepare to rewrite the constitution of the state of Oaxaca. And what came out of that was a 250-person statewide council that includes representatives from many different indigenous communities, representatives from neighborhoods and barricades, representatives from the women who took over the state television station, and from longstanding leftist organizations and unions here in Oaxaca. And again, they still are using more or less the consensus-based decision-making model in extremely lengthy meetings where they are now discussing the sort of future plan of action for the movement in Oaxaca. It was a 3-day Congress with every night going until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and you know, very contested. I mean, there was a lot of it wasn't an easy three days of Congress, but that's what they came out with, was a 250-person statewide council, and that council has announced, among other things, that if Ulises Ruiz does not leave his post as governor before December 1st, that the OPPO will do everything in its power, together with other social movements around Mexico, to prevent fraudulently elected President Felipe Calderon from taking office on December 1st.
So they're basically vowing to make it an even wider movement beyond the state of Oaxaca to the whole country, and escalate it if Ruiz does not step down by December 1st.
Yeah, and there's reason to believe that is entirely possible, because while there's always been quite a bit of solidarity for the movement from other parts of Mexico and from other parts of the world, between October 27th, when paramilitaries killed 3 people, and October 29th, when the federal police entered, the number of solidarity mobilizations that took place around the country escalated dramatically, with highways being blockaded in Chiapas and Guerrero and Michoacán. Teachers in several different states around the country went out on strike. People took over buildings and blockaded streets in Mexico City. And movements that already exist in Mexico City, like the Zapatista Otra Campaña and the movement that arose in July against the electoral fraud, which is known as the Vote by Vote movement, also came out in solidarity with the movement. All of those movements are also vowing to make Inauguration Day a very difficult day for Felipe Calderon and for the political interests behind him.
So I know this is a somewhat separate topic in a sense, although it's really quite connected. There was a massacre in Chiapas Monday, November 13th, is the news I've heard. Presumed paramilitaries committed a massacre in Montes Azules jungle region of Chiapas, killing 9 indigenous women and men and 2 children. I'm wondering if this is news in Oaxaca, and if so, if the people are making connections between what's going on in Chiapas and what's going on in Oaxaca, and if you could talk about that.
Yeah, people are definitely, it's definitely news in Oaxaca, and people are definitely making connections. I mean, it's very related in the sense that there the long, especially in southern Mexico, long-standing corruption between the state governments and landowners and private interests in natural resources have always have a long history of carrying out repression and evicting people from their land in indigenous communities. And it's the same story of what's happened in Oaxaca for decades as well, is those three powers coming together, government interests, private interests, and landowners repressing indigenous communities, especially in Oaxaca, the alliance being with the PRI, which has held constant power in Oaxaca for the last 70-something years. So people are definitely making those connections and understanding that, you know, the paramilitaries that attacked Montes Azules and Chiapas military and police operatives paid by the government, just like the military and police operatives who've been paid by the government here to gun down members of the popular movement in Oaxaca.
Do you have any more details on that, on the massacre that happened in Chiapas? What has come out in the press there?
I don't have a lot of details just because that things in Oaxaca have been kind of nonstop, and I haven't had a lot of time. But I think the two most current sources of information in English on that are narconews.com and Indie Media Chiapas have been doing constant updates on that situation. So those would be good places to look for more information.
Has there been any actions that have taken place where you are in response to that, in response to that massacre?
I haven't seen any specifically in Oaxaca in response to that, and I think partly that's just because the movement here as it is so, it's in this situation of being in a city that's occupied by federal police and trying to track down a number of people who've been disappeared and detained, and the mobilizations that they have been able to carry out here have really been in direct response to that. So I haven't seen any mobilization specifically in response to the Montes Azules massacre.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Jill Friedberg from Oaxaca. She is in Oaxaca right now. We're talking about the continuing struggle there and the current situation, as well as a little bit of the background. And Jill, I'm wondering if you could talk about what relation, if any, the U.S. government has to what's happening in Oaxaca, in Chiapas, and in Mexico in general. You could be specific about Oaxaca if you'd like, but what is the U.S. government role, if any, in the developments there?
You know, it's actually hard to be really specific. I mean, the U.S. government certainly has a long history of training military and paramilitary forces in southern Mexico, whether at the School of the Americas or here in Mexico. A lot of the weaponry used here by the police forces, both state and federal, that are in Oaxaca, clearly comes from the U.S. Large numbers, for example, of tear gas canisters have been collected, and they're all made in the U.S. And then the State Department has been issuing travel alerts. Sounds sort of light, but, you know, in their travel alerts, where they've been now for several months telling people not to come to Oaxaca, and recently, just this week, announced that people should probably not come to Mexico at all. They've been using the language has been, I think, has contributed to the conflict, in the sense that, for example, they'll say, we advise people not to go to Oaxaca because of violent protests and exchange of gunfire between protesters and police forces and that sort of thing, which actually is a gross misrepresentation of what's happening here. If any tourist was in danger here, it would be more from the paramilitary forces that drive around at night shooting at people, or the federal police who launch tear gas canisters into the middle of a busy street on market day. There's not one single documented case of any tourist or other visitor to Oaxaca having any difficulties with movement participants. So I would say that also the State Department has added to the misrepresentation of the movement and to the intensity of the conflict by misrepresenting the movement and by scaring tourists off, because there are small businesses who have suffered greatly from the drop in tourism. And I'd say that it's more the State Department that scared them off than the movement itself. And finally, I think that the U.S. has a profound interest in Felipe Calderon being the next president of Mexico, and to to that extent, I would guess that they're willing to do just about anything to make sure that social movements in Mexico do not impede his entering office. And of course, we have a long history of intervening in all kinds of ways in social movements in Latin America when it appears that they might threaten U.S. interests.
What about the U.S. government support, and there our government's certainly been a driving force behind NAFTA, behind the FTAA. What about the effects and impacts of economic globalization there?
Well, I mean, Oaxaca is a case example. It's full of natural resources, from mineral resources to water to wind power to timber, and definitely foreign private interests, not only from the U.S., but also, for example, from Canada and Spain, have made huge investments in projects in Oaxaca that have had devastating impacts on rural and indigenous communities. And the state and local governments in Oaxaca have way on the top of their list of priorities protecting those investments and protecting those private interests and making sure at all costs that those foreign investors do not pull out of the projects that they've established in Oaxaca. So certainly putting down a social movement that might scare off investors is a huge priority for the state and local governments in Oaxaca. And the people of Oaxaca understand that. They have a profound understanding of economic globalization, neoliberalism, and the threat that foreign investors who come to remove natural resources from the state, the threat that that poses to not only to their economic well-being, but also to their actual sovereignty and their ability to live out their lives on their land without being displaced by projects and foreign investment.
I want to remind people they're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, and streaming online at freakradio.org. I'm speaking with Jill Friedberg. She's an award-winning Seattle filmmaker, and she's in Oaxaca right now. She made a film in 2005 called Granito de Arena about the teachers' struggle there that's been going on now for about 26 years. And again, this has turned into a wider struggle with the OPPO. And you spoke about how there was this recent conference that took place, or Congress that took place, and some of the outcome of that. Has there been, I keep hearing rumors that the teachers are going to return to work, and then that doesn't happen. What is going on with that?
The teachers have actually, as of this past week, have returned to work after being out on strike for almost 5 months. And that was a very turbulent process. The teachers' union in Oaxaca, while it's a democratic local that does have a 26-year history of popular struggle, it's also a union structure, and it does also have a long history of more than anything of leadership selling out. And that appears to be what happened again this year, where the Secretary General of the union suddenly announced on national television, I believe this was in early October, that teachers would be returning to classes. It was just a matter of determining the date, and the movement's response to that, both by teachers and other participants in the popular movement, was an immediate rejection of that. And the leader of the movement has basically not been seen since then. But it was a blow to the teachers' movement because it created a lot of confusion and a lot of division. And what happened was that they carried out several what they call consultas, which is basically a rank and file consult, or you know, rank and file vote whether or not to return to classes. And ultimately, they decided to return to classes for a lot of different reasons. One was that they had not been paid in over 2 months, and we're talking about families where, in many cases, both the mother and father of the family are teachers, and that's their only source of income. But also because Oaxaca is primarily a rural state. Every community has at least one teacher. And in a lot of those communities, there's a very profound commitment felt by teachers to those communities. And I think they were starting to really feel a lot of pressure from community leadership that they return to classes, and that they've really been trying to find a way to return to classes without giving up the struggle, and to mobilize, take advantage of being back in their communities, to mobilize in their communities in meetings with parents and community authorities. And so far, in some parts of the state, that's exactly what they've done. In the Isthmus southern region of Oaxaca State, there were several days of blockades of the Pan American Highway carried out by teachers and community members in places where teachers had gone back to teach and had been as well organized in their communities. But also, I mean, since June, when this movement went from being a teacher's strike to a popular movement, the movement has repeated again and again. This isn't just a teacher's movement. This is a popular movement. And so when the teachers began deciding to return to classes, there was really this discussion about, well, maybe it's time for the teachers to pass the torch a little bit, in the sense that they were the ones who had really been carrying the brunt of the sacrifices of having left their communities, left their source of income to come sleep in the streets and put their lives on the line, guarding barricades that were being shot up by paramilitaries. And if this was really a popular movement, then other movement participants were going to have to kind of step up and fill the shoes of the teachers for a while, so that they could keep their commitment with community authorities. And that's basically what's happened. I mean, it's notable that the teachers aren't all in the city of Oaxaca anymore. But you do see people from, for one thing, the teachers who teach within an hour or two of Oaxaca City and in the city, when they finish teaching in the afternoon, they come down to the encampment. They're there right now because it's the weekend. But also you see people from the university. The university students have really been playing a very fundamental role in the last few weeks. And people from neighborhoods, people who are guarding barricades for 6 weeks, participating, coming out in marches and other mobilizations. But it's sort of a transitional moment. I think people are really waiting to see, like, how is this going to work out without the teachers on strike? And I'm fairly certain that the teachers going back to teach, while it may not have come right out and said it, is conditional on if there's another wave of outright repression. I'm sure, you know, the teachers are prepared to go out on strike again and come back to the city.
Right. So, last weekend, the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca had a week-long Congress from November 10th through the 12th, and there were marches planned for every day this week. You talked at the beginning of the interview about the women's march that took place this last week, where they were protesting in part some of the sexual harassment from the federal police there in Oaxaca City. And there's been a continued some members of OPPO continue to be in the university and on the radio, though that is being interfered with to some degree. So one of the outcomes that you mentioned was that there was a decision that if Ruiz does not step down by December 1st, this will turn into a wider movement to prevent Calderon from taking office as president. How would you sum up briefly the current situation? Is that a pretty good summary of it, or if you could just sum it up, what the current situation is there?
Yeah, I'd say that is a pretty good summary. The movement is the movement knows that the federal police cannot remain in occupying the center of town forever, and they also know that the level of national mobilization that's likely to happen on December 1st for Inauguration Day. And I think in the meantime, the movement is doing its best to maintain a presence without bringing down an unnecessary level of repression from the federal police forces, and is also somewhat in the defensive position right now of trying to respond to the ongoing detentions and disappearances of people within the movement. Movement the people who've been perceived to be movement leaders or people who've been very visible and participating in the movement are having to change, you know, sleep in different places every night. There's a long list of people who are basically under, you know, under a very high threat of being either killed by paramilitaries or being detained by federal police and federal intelligence agents. So the movement is sort of in that stage of trying to figure out how it's going to respond on December 1st when Felipe Calderon enters office, tries to enter office, and how, in the meantime, to protect itself from the federal police and the paramilitary forces, and at the same time carrying out daily mobilizations, whether those are marches or rallies or then other kinds of what I consider very creative responses to the presence of the federal police. I mean, at any time of the day, you can go by the police lines that are guarding the Zocalo, and people are there doing theater performances in front of them, or on Day of the Dead, people erected altars to the people who died in the movement directly in front of the police lines. People go down and play movement music for them at very high volumes and that sort of thing. So that's basically the movement's trying to avoid confrontation with the federal police and while not demobilizing, and also working on the national level to coordinate with other movements to confront Inauguration Day.
I just have a couple more questions for you, Jill, then we'll wrap it up. I am wondering what the situation is with the killers of Brad Will, because, and again, he was the New York City indie media journalist who was killed on October 27th, shot in the stomach by local officials and died. There was some people who photographed his killers, and they've actually been identified, and we heard, you know, in the media that they were going to be apprehended or that they had been, then we heard they weren't in custody. What's the current situation with those who are identified as being directly responsible for Brad's murder?
The state claims that they have detained those two people, although several journalists attempt to actually find what jail they were in and confirm that they've been detained, as far as I know, have been unsuccessful. What's more worrisome is that last week the Attorney General of the state of Oaxaca came out with a new theory saying that Brad Will was actually killed by movement participants that day to internationalize the conflict, and they have a whole theory about how that happened and that he was shot there while filming and then later shot some 20 minutes later while in a car where he was being transported to the hospital.
Do they have any evidence to support these claims?
Their evidence is, first of all, the evidence is all coming from the state coroner who works for the governor of the state of Oaxaca. The first coroner's report that came out right after Brad died said that he was shot from over 50 meters away and that the abdominal wound that resulted from that killed him within 10 minutes. And then suddenly the state coroner comes out last week with this completely different analysis saying that Brad survived for quite some time after having been shot and that movement participants shot him a second time in the car while taking him to the hospital. And
right, his and comrades their
evidence,
murdered him.
Their evidence, for example, is that in the video that Brad was actually filming while, when he was killed, that you hear somebody in the group of protesters that were around him, somebody off to his side saying, "Didn't I tell you to stop filming?" And we do hear that, but we hear that kind of thing often when we're filming in difficult moments here in Oaxaca. And that certainly to me is an evidence that that they then pulled out a gun and shot him. And furthermore, it's just sort of logistically impossible because he was clearly, everybody who's seen the photo of his injury can see that he was shot straight on. And you can see in his video that there's nobody standing in front of him pointing a gun at him other than the people over 50 meters away, the paramilitaries who attacked the barricade. So, you know, when it was when the original theory that he was killed by the paramilitaries came out, there wasn't much said on behalf of the United States government in terms of further investigating and bringing to justice the situation. But now that the Attorney General has come out and said that he was killed by the movement, suddenly there's been, the U.S. is sort of clamoring for a profound investigation and that sort of thing. And, you know...
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this, basically what it comes down to for me is that this second coroner's report came out by a state coroner who's either in favor of the government that he works for, or knows that if he didn't come out with that coroner's report, he would be the next one. He'd be the next person having a coroner's report written about him.
Right.
And the news that we have from Brad's family is that Brad was cremated, which rules out the possibility of an additional autopsy being carried out in the United States.
They didn't have an autopsy in the United States?
I don't know for sure, so I probably shouldn't comment. But,
right.
Okay. I don't know for
sure.
Wow.
So the government, despite the claims of the second coroner and the hypothesis being put, who's putting forward again this hypothesis that it
the,
might...
The Attorney General okay. for the state of Oaxaca.
So you're saying despite all that, they have detained some of the local government officials that were photographed that initially was reported they were responsible for the murder.
Right.
They claim to have detained them at the same time that there's some... hypothesis being put forward that this might have been movement members?
Yeah, they claim that those two people have been detained, although it's been difficult to confirm that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, well, my final question today was how can people here support the struggle there in Oaxaca?
Well, I think the main thing is for people to who have access to information about what's happening in Oaxaca, who understand the situation, to work on informing other people, to do video screenings, to hold teach-ins. There's now more information that's available in English, in the media, for example, and narco news, but there's also a lot more information coming out in Spanish, so people who are bilingual who could do translation of articles, that's also something that's needed. And the very visible solidarity actions, I think, have a big impact, marches and protests, even if they're small, just a few people making noise outside of the local Mexican consulate, I think that does have a big impact. What was the other thing I was going to suggest? Those are the main things, helping get the information out, and helping maintain a sort of visible rejection to the repression in Oaxaca, and calling, an international call for the governor to leave office and for the repression to stop.
Can you suggest some sources for people to get information?
In English?
That or in a place where, I mean, there's Oaxaca Indymedia, which is in Spanish but can be translated through Google. Into English. You just translate the page. But
right.
Whatever,
well,
Spanish or English, it's okay.
In English, the New York City Indie Media site, Los Angeles, I think there's actually an OPPO was formed in Los Angeles because there's a massive Oaxacan population there. And they started a website, although I can't remember it offhand, but it's LAOPPO.org. I'm not exactly sure. Narco News, which is NARCONEWS.com, is regularly reporting in English. If you go back into the archive of Democracy Now, they have also done several reports. There's a paper called The Herald, which is in Mexico, is a Mexico newspaper, but in English, and they have a website, and there have been regular reports there. As far as more mainstream sources that have been doing a fairly good job, the Houston Chronicle has been doing a pretty good job of covering the movement. I'm fairly certain they still have a correspondent down here. And then in Spanish, Indymedia Oaxaca also has a multimedia site where there's quite a few videos that have been posted. And La Jornada is probably the best newspaper. La Jornada and Las Noticias de Oaxaca both have internet versions where there's daily information in Spanish. It'd be great if people could work on translating that stuff, but if you just want to read Spanish, those are good sources. And Telemundo in Los Angeles has also surprisingly been doing some pretty good reporting on the Los Angeles Telemundo station in Spanish. One other thing I wanted to add is that there's a correspondent in Oaxaca writing for the Associated Press, whose articles are being regularly translated into English and sent around to every newspaper in the United States. Her name is Rebecca Romero. I don't believe that she's a journalist. None of the journalists down here believe that she's a journalist. And her reports have consistently, since May, been extremely inaccurate and extremely pro-government. So if you're reading your local newspaper and informing yourself about Oaxaca by what's in the Associated Press, if you see the name Rebecca Romero at the top of the article, it's better that you don't read it at all, because they've just been horribly inaccurate. And there's actually a group of journalists who are talking about assembling the list of inaccuracies of all of her articles since June and launching a formal complaint to the Associated Press.
Well, thanks for letting us know about that. What's her name again?
Rebecca Romero.
Rebecca Romero, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Jill. I really appreciate you taking the time to
No problem. I appreciate the opportunity.
This. And take care, and we'll be in touch.
Okay. You take care, too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Again, that was Jill Friedberg. She is a Seattle filmmaker, an award-winning Seattle filmmaker. She produced the film This Is What Democracy Looks Like in 2000, which won numerous awards. She also produced a film in 2005 called Granito de Arena, which is the story of the popular resistance in Mexico to the global economic forces that have been dismantling public education for over 20 years. It's the story of hundreds of thousands of public school teachers whose grassroots nonviolent movement took Mexico by surprise and who have endured brutal repression in their 26-year struggle for social and economic justice in Mexico's public schools. Jill Friedberg spent 2 years in southern Mexico documenting the efforts of over 100,000 teachers, parents, and students fighting to defend the country's public education system from the devastating impacts of economic globalization. If you want to see this film, which combines footage of strikes and direct actions with 25 years worth of archival images and delivers a compelling and unsettling story of resistance, repression, commitment, and solidarity, you can check out the website corrugate.org and read about the film and get it that way. And that is spelled C-O-R-R-U-G-A-T-E, corrugate.org. To find out about that film, Granito de Arena. Of course, you can also read about the film This Is What Democracy Looks Like as well, and some of the other projects of Corrugated Films at corrugate.org. So I also want to let you know that another source to not only get information, but to donate in support of the people of Oaxaca is El Enemigo Común. That stands for the common enemy and is spelled ELENEMIGOCOMUN. And the website is www.elenemigocomun.net. And at that website, you can read about Oaxaca solidarity demonstrations. You can also donate in solidarity with Oaxaca. This project, El Enemigo Común, and another organization are collaborating on a Oaxaca solidarity fundraising strategy, which is based in contributing media resources and medical supplies to some of Oaxaca's most remote indigenous farm worker communities. And they list off the organizations they're directly contributing to. And you can read about that and donate at elenemigocomun.net.